Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Universities have been offering business education for more than a century now. Business has become the most popular college major worldwide, and the MBA track has become huge. Now a serious critic, Harvard Business School's Rakesh Khurana, says B schools have seriously lost their way, have lost track of their mission to produce top-notch stewards of the nation's economy, and instead are turning out hotshot consultants and hedge fund guys who slice and dice American business, take the money, and run. This hour, On Point, a tough critique of the American MBA and what B schools have become. You can join the conversation. Are American business schools educating for the future of American business success, or for quick millions right now? And good luck to you. We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Joining me in the studio is Rakesh Khurana. He's associate professor in organizational behavior at Harvard Business School, and he's out with a big new book, From Higher Aims to Hired Hands, The Social Transformation of American Business Schools and the Unfulfilled Promise of Management as a Profession. It's a mouthful, and it's jammed with big ideas. This weekend, the Guardian newspaper in London called it a provocative and timely intervention. Rakesh Khurana, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
So what's the problem here? MBAs are supposed to be a great thing. Business schools supposed to be great for American business and the economy, we thought. What's the critique?
Well, the argument that I make in the book is that the original intention of the founding of the university-based business school was to create management as a profession. Mm-hmm. And by profession, they meant a variety of different things. But the most important part was not just the distinction that we often make between a novice and an expert, such as a professional chef or an amateur cook, but a profession in its full normative sense. That is, a capable body of individuals who, using a carefully scripted and described body of knowledge, use that knowledge to advance society's interests rather than private interests.
Adam Smith had his invisible hand. This would be the visible hand that would make capitalism work.
That's exactly right. The period in which business schools arose was a very difficult period in the United States. It was the big shifts going on between an agrarian and an industrial society, and significant social questions about in whose interest should the large corporation be run. Should it be run in the interest of shareholders in the form of trust? Should it be run in the interest of labor through unions? Should it be run in the interest of the state in the form of regulation or even state ownership? And it was in this period, the late 19th, early 20th century, that this new group of individuals, managers, presented themselves as stewards of these large corporations who would run these institutions not in the interests of labor or shareholders or the state, but in the interests of society. And the way they legitimated their authority and the control of the large corporation was partially due to a project that they undertook with a few business school entrepreneurs that started linking management to the institutions of science, particularly the form of Taylorism and scientific management, that linked management as an emerging profession the way medicine, law, the clergy were professions.
So this would be a real discipline, a real profession.
That's right.
When you say in the interests of society, if that's not labor and shareholders and all the rest, what is that? What exactly is society? That can mean everything or nothing.
Well, in society, they had some very specific ideas, in particular contribution to the social order. During this period, there was a lot of fighting going on between capital and labor in the form of mm-hmm. strikes. There was a great deal of social unrest. And by what they meant by society is that in the best interest of advancing the democratic and free aspirations of the nation, that the economy was a means toward an end, not an end in itself.
So B schools were to turn out professional graduates who would, with their visible hand, with their work in business, support democracy and freedom.
Support democracy and freedom, and specifically by doing this through a stakeholder model that adjudicated the variety of interests between labor, capital, and the state, and basically using their judgment, their professional judgment, would run the corporations in that nation's best, in our nation's best interest.
For the greater good.
For the greater good.
All right. Now, it's a long way between then and now. But the greater good no longer, at least at an explicit level, seems like the goal. I mean, it's shareholders good, it's big money, quick. Are B schools still turning out graduates who are educated to work for the greater good or something else? And what does it matter?
Well, I think there's two questions. One is that the economy and the society in which business schools were founded has changed quite dramatically. If you look at the elite business schools, fewer and fewer students are actually interested in pursuing a managerial career in a large industrial corporation or in a large corporation. They're increasingly interested in being agents of managers in the form of consultants, investment bankers, or professional investors in the form of private equity or hedge funds. The question about whether this matters or not is really the question, I think, that goes to the point of students are not being trained as professionals in the sense that these individuals meant, that is, seeing their work as in the best interests of society rather than in private interests, how does that bode for the quality of our society's business leadership? Business has become the most dominant institution in the 21st century. In many cases, it's sometimes stronger than some of the nation states. Individual businesses can be in that kind of position. And the question is that are we turning out an enlightened business leadership that recognizes its responsibility that goes beyond the narrow interests of the shareholders? If you look at the kinds of problems that we are now confronting as a global society, pandemics, global climate change, sustainability, these are issues that business can have a big impact on helping to solve. But I believe, and I would contend, that it can only help doing that if it's populated by an enlightened business leadership that sees its responsibilities going beyond the shareholder logic, which has really dominated over these last couple of decades.
Well, let's dig into that. I mean, are B-schools really supposed to turn out Albert Schweitzers or Gordon Geckos? I mean, humanitarians or ruthless business leaders? There's a huge school of thought, of course you know it well, that says, hey, go out and be just as ruthless in the market as you can. That's what the market is supposed to do, winnow out what's not working. Maybe those big industrial corporations that you describe as needing managers, maybe that's not America's strength anymore. Maybe what we should be excelling in right now is hedge fund management and the economies that are supposed to fall out of them, sort of pulling the scythe through American industry.
I think, you know, that might be the right place to end. The question is that have business schools gotten to this position either through purpose of strategy or through drift? If we go back to the history, the notion of the founding of this business education was, in fact, there were lots of for-profit business schools that existed before the university business schools. Uh-huh. There were scores of these institutions educating tens of thousands of students a year. They were delegitimated by the university-based business school because they were argued to only teach narrow technical skills and basically not fulfill their students with any purpose that went beyond narrow careerism. Now, the question is it still an issue for society that we are looking for a kind of quality of business leadership that takes its responsibilities in a broader way? If we look at polls such as who are the most trusted occupations, who are the most trusted professions, the trust in business as a profession, trust in corporate leaders has gone down dramatically in recent years. I would contend, if you're a big fan of the free enterprise system and the capitalist system as I am, that to the extent that that system is seen as illegitimate or the individuals there not seen as running the corporations or organizations in the best interest of society, that's a problem. It takes away from the legitimacy of the institution. And moreover, I think it challenges in many ways business schools, which are public institutions. We exist in private universities that are tax supported. We have unique labor market contracts that really give us a sacred responsibility for producing a type of leadership that sees its activities as going beyond the narrow self-interest of making as much money as I can as quickly as I can.
So you're not churning out managers who will make American business, American industry, the American economy great, you're suggesting. Instead, you're churning out agents, consultants, investment bankers, hedge fund hotshots who what? I mean, we said slicing and dicing. I mean, they're not doing nothing out there. Is all that really a waste? Is all that not producing some kind of benefit?
No, I think that's a very important, you know, the capital markets and how they work is a very important part of our system. The argument that I would present in the book is that while that was recognized as an important part in the establishment of university-based business schools, the founders of the business schools, the social entrepreneurs behind it, said that that's not going to be our particular role. We're not interested in producing those professional investors or the traders. What we're interested in producing are managers who are going to administer these enterprises, who will create economic wealth through the production of goods and services, not merely through speculative activities. I think those activities that you outlined, hedge funds, private equity, are obviously important. They help lubricate the system. Joseph Schumpeter talked about the importance of evaporated capital. Mm-hmm. But he argued that you'd want a society in which evaporated capital was not the total percentage of the economic activity. In fact, that the benefit on the welfare of society really depended on the people managing and administering the hard capital of society.
I want to understand what you're really saying here. Are you saying that if business schools had done their job correctly, we would not have seen so much American, let's say, manufacturing go abroad, that the American economy might be stronger than it is, that we'd have lower unemployment, higher incomes, a better economic future for this country? Are you describing a kind of betrayal on that scale or something else?
What I'm saying is that the original social contract upon which business schools were founded, which was to create management as a profession in the form of the criteria outlined earlier, is not part of the contemporary discourse in business education.
Okay, discourse, schmiscourse. What people really care about at the end of the day is, how's the economy doing? Would we have been better off with more, you know, institutional corporate managers? I mean, we sort of were told that that was history. In the 1970s, 80s, we were told that was slow, lumbering, old. We needed to be faster. We needed to be jet stream. Could our economy have looked differently today if American business schools had seen their mission differently, had stuck with that original idea?
I think it's difficult for me to speculate if our economy would look different. What I would argue is that our business leadership would probably regard its purpose and mission differently. Mm-hmm. It would not be seen that the sole purpose of the corporation, for example, is to maximize shareholder value, that in fact the corporations have a broader sense of responsibilities. What I'm trying to do with the book is demonstrate that this was a historically contingent idea, mm-hmm. and that it wasn't always so the way we describe what the purpose of the corporation, the purpose of management is.
This is at the heart of a lot of the American economy, and certainly at the heart of business education. Rakesh Khurana is with us. His new book is From Higher Aims to Hired Hands. You can join the conversation. What do you think? Are American MBAs now trained to tear up, not build up, American businesses? Are we training too many hedge fund managers and not enough titans of industry? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the MBA and the U.S. economy and whether America's business schools and their graduates are letting down American business. My guest is Rakesh Khurana. He's associate professor in organizational behavior at Harvard Business School. He's out with a big new book, From Higher Aims to Hired Hands, and it is a very tough critique of the job that American B schools are doing these days. You can join us. What do you think? If the best and the brightest are now slicing and dicing companies instead of building them, is this a good thing? And what's a B school's job? To educate hired guns for shareholders or community builders for the nation? Is Rakesh Khurana too idealistic? Is it all about creative destruction and shareholder value? We're at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Kevin is calling from Fall River, Massachusetts. Kevin, you're on the air.
Hey, hello. Yeah, I'm just wondering if there's, there's a core contradiction that was, was there 100 years ago and still isn't here now, and that in large part that what the professor is suggesting are reforms, but those reforms are going to be dashed, like dashed hopes, in the sense that capitalism, probably the core value of capitalism, is maximizing profit for private individuals. And to say that some other kinds of values or goals should call that into question, or make that, that core value of capitalism something other than that, to a certain extent, is to say that you want something other than capitalism, and that the academy's role, to a large extent, even then and now, might be to somehow give legitimacy, a branding, to that capitalism by, giving some kind of professionalism and what have you. But when it comes to dealing with realities of that core belief, it's not capable of addressing it through just reformist measures.
Kevin, a fascinating perspective. There's a realist and a skeptic at the same time, Rakesh. What do you say to Kevin?
Well, I think, Kevin gets to a very important point. When you look at the founders of business schools, this was precisely the question about what the critics had, which is why do we need a business school in a university?
And why give them the mantle of the high moral purpose of a university?
That's right. I mean, and that was the significant critique. The response was that the founders of the business schools, people like President Charles Eliot of Harvard or Joseph Wharton, believed that business was about something much more, that given its size and significance in the United States, it had not only a private responsibility but a public responsibility. And as a result, if you were running corporations solely by the invisible hand, that did not take into account the numerous externalities that were really being created at that time, externalities for labor, externalities for the environment.
Side effects of that invisible hand.
And sometimes negative. That's right. And if you wanted to create a stable social order, for example, during this period, there was a lot of radicalism among the labor movement. And there was a great fear that we would have a socialist or a communist type of strong movement in the United States. And the idea is if you could get managers not to use their authority arbitrarily, but rather to use their authority in an objective way in which labor could understand its responsibilities, in which shareholders had some say in what happened, but in fact were not the only constituent to which managers had to respond, you could create a more stable economic platform.
But that's a long time ago. We've been through a lot of sort of iterations of what everybody thinks about things now. We wanted to talk with Steve Kaplan, University of Chicago. He wanted to join us, but he's teaching a class right now. But he said, not long ago, told the Boston Globe, speaking of you here, and this goes to Kevin's point about whether is what you're really critiquing capitalism itself. Stephen Kaplan at University of Chicago said of you, Rakesh, he said he's confused. It's hard to understand why you, is saying there's a problem or a failure. By and large, the goal of maximizing shareholder value does the right thing for companies, and in the long run, it's good for the economies in which companies operate. You serve society by creating value. Are you disagreeing with that? And if you are you opting out of capitalism?
No, I think you do serve society by creating economic value. But is fostering economic growth the sole purpose of a university-based business school? I think by framing the debate within the bounds of the instrumental values of business education, we're really missing a key responsibility of what education is about. We're ignoring lots of important concerns that go beyond the quantitative measures like economic growth. While productivity and economic growth are important, there are fairly narrow dimensions around which to build justification and foundation for something like a university-based business education. Moreover, I would contend that if we look at some of the contemporary issues around executive compensation, look at the issues around governance, it's precisely this narrowing logic of the purpose of the corporation that's really raised some serious concerns about is business being run in the best interest of society.
So the out-of-control CEO pay packages, the kind of Enron problems we saw. I mean, these were MBA grads who were running Enron.
And moreover, they were using techniques like stock options the idea that the shareholder was the only legitimate constituent to legitimate these type of ideas. And these were ideas.
And being tutored in those by their business schools as thousands are right now.
That's right. And my worry is that if you sort of train people with just pure technical skills and you do not give them the normative logic about how you use those technical skills, you've educated mercenaries. Not Marines. And the vision that the founders of business schools had was that by giving people a sense of the profession, by giving them the high responsibilities of profession, they would use these technical skills, but not just in a narrow self-interested way, but in a way that was considered about its second-order implications for society.
Rakesh Khurana, stand by for just a moment. I want to get some perspective here, if we may. I want to turn to Edward Roberts, professor of management of technology at MIT's Sloan School of Business, founder and chair of the MIT Entrepreneurship Center, author of 11 books, including Entrepreneurs in High Technology. Edward Roberts, thank you very much for being with us.
I'm delighted to be here, Tom. I'm a daily listener to NPR, and I probably hear you three or four times a week.
Well, it's great to have you. You hear the Rakesh Khurana critique. You know him well. The charge is, I mean, to boil it down, it sounds sort of, greed is good, Gordon Gekko, but he's kind of saying B-schools are turning out heartless, technical, number-crunching devils and have lost their high moral purpose, and it's got to stop. What do you say?
Well, I think it's a bit like the blind man walking around the elephant and trying to figure out what it is that he's touching. And what you're familiar with is what you tend to see and imagine. It may very well be that despite the fact that Rakesh has done a careful historical analysis of where business schools came from, that I have a feeling he's too much of a, affected by the particular business school students that he's looking at, who may in fact be short swing people going to markets and focusing on Wall Street and the like.
Now, wait a minute. Is this just MIT dissing Harvard here? Is that what we've got going?
Well, let's make it a different statement.
Mm-hmm.
I don't observe the strength of phenomenon that Rakesh claims exists. What I see at the MIT Sloan School is that the two most vibrant programs at Sloan today are the Entrepreneurship and Innovation program I started a year ago that has a third of the Sloan School students wanting to build companies and to create value on their own hook by committing themselves, their efforts, their passion to job creation, innovation creation, and the like. And the second most vibrant activity is the sustainability thrust, in which we have large numbers of our MBA students focusing on what can they do to improve the world and improve the environment and how can they change practices. So it may well be that Rakesh could have been right, or maybe he's right for a subsample of business schools, but I doubt very much that the bulk of the elite business schools, including his own as part of that elite group.
Yep, at Harvard Business School,
yeah.
Yep.
I doubt very much that they really today are the kind of places that he's criticized.
All right, let's. There's a spiky retort. Rakesh Khurana, how about it? Are you able to make the case that this that the problem you're describing is the case across the board? Is it a generalized problem, or do you just happen to be in a realm of, you know, hell-bent for leather hedge fund hotshots who, you know, devil take the hindmost guys?
Well, I used to teach at MIT, so it's nice to be on with Ed. I think there's Ed's pointing to an important issue. There's a great deal of variance across business schools and a great deal of variance across the MBA. And I think this is precisely points to the challenge and the issue that MBA education faces as a profession. One definition of a profession is that you agree upon what it is that students need to know. What is the what constitutes the body of knowledge? What we're seeing in MBA education is what I would call institutional fragmentation and the deinstitutionalization of it, the degree. So in some schools, like MIT, entrepreneurship tends to be put forward and innovation tends to be put forward. In other schools, like Stanford, they're doing the individual MBA, where basically the students decide what it is that they want to do. In other schools, the focus is on leadership. And I think this really points to the institutional issue, which is that you can get some very high-quality education in particular MBA programs. On the other hand, you can also get online MBA degrees from a for-profit institution. And I think the problem is that this high variance is really, you know, really points to the question, is this just merely a technical degree, or does it represent something more than just a series of functional courses that come together to provide some coherence around what we think about it as a profession?
So this is the notion of professional standards across the degree. But let me go to something Ed Roberts said there. His suggestion is that an MBA student who's focused on entrepreneurship is somehow more immune to this amoral pursuit of hedge fund slicing and dicing than you're describing, less a captive of investor capitalism. But Enron was an entrepreneurial company at one point. Do you accept that premise, that entrepreneurship is different?
Well, I think, you know, when I think about it, it's hard for me to move beyond the data, which is that when I looked at the aggregate data of elite business schools, 2/3 of the students were going into consulting and investment banking jobs. And obviously, there's another
2/3.
2/3.
Wow.
And obviously, there's another 1/3 who are choosing either to work for traditional companies or going into entrepreneurship. The question I think that this goes back to in some ways is really a question of what is it that we're trying to teach the students? I think entrepreneurship is an important part of the economy. But if we go back to Joseph Schumpeter's notions of what entrepreneurship, which is a sort of form of creative destruction, the idea that it comes from some regulated social structure like a business school, that you can actually teach it is kind of goes against the analytical definition of what an entrepreneur is and what entrepreneurship is. If we look at
that's a very interesting slam that you can't teach entrepreneurship, but you can teach managership. It's very interesting in our world of baseball emphasis in Boston
yep.
to remember that Babe Ruth had a batting coach. And the implication is that if you want to guide young students into careers that have direction and purpose, providing the coaching that gives them that direction and the encouragement is what you want to do.
But Edward Roberts, let me ask you, if I may then, when you look out at the American business scene today, at the ranks of, you know, young hotshots who are moving up into positions there, we look at the story of Jeff Skilling and Andy Fastow at Enron, look at the kind of investor capitalism at high tilt in the hedge fund craze right now. Do you see this as a healthy thing? And if not entirely, do you see American B-Schools as bearing some responsibility for the shape of that face of our economy today?
I certainly see that those are problems. I don't see the Enron-like behavior or Tyco behavior. By the way, Tyco's an old Massachusetts company. That kind of behavior is desirable. But I also don't think that it's the responsibility of the business school to try to overcome the phenomenon of the marketplace. It's the market that is really the source of evil, but yet it's the source of good. The market is driving, the stock market is driving short-term orientation by managers instead of long-term innovation and long-term perspectives for building companies. The market is doing that. What would we rather do? Do we therefore want to get rid of the stock market because the impact is to cause managers to worry about quarterly results? No, I think we need to try to figure out how do we tame that in some way, or how do we develop counter values. Now, the business school recognize is training people who are getting out of school at age 26, 27, and the like. They are not the CEOs who are leading these disasters. Those people are long away from any business school education that they had. And consequently, I think to associate what goes on in today's business schools, which really is what we're concerned with,
yes,
not what went on 20 years ago.
Well, okay, maybe.
So
okay.
What goes on in today's business school with what is happening among the senior managers of industry, that's a big leap.
Orkesh Khurana, how about it? The market, it's the market's problem, not the B-School's problem. And these are old bulls anyway. It's not the young, fresh grads from B-School who are shaping this economy.
Well, I think this is really gets to the heart of my argument, which is that there's two different types of logic that we can talk about how you want to train business people. One is market logic, which talks about the role of price and the role of capital markets and shareholders. And the other is what's called professional logic. And professional logic is a different type of way of thinking about things. It's about thinking about a self-regulating body that doesn't need a Sarbanes-Oxley to regulate it.
Come on, it's about it's a lawyer's hand.
I mean, that professional logic, it sounds sort of like business bureaucrat, Eastern European economy circa 1975. At least we've been led to think of it that way, Rakesh. Is that really what you're proposing?
Well, you know, professional logic in its kind of definition really means a commitment, for example, to use one's technical skills and one's knowledge for the advancement of the client's interest or societal interest rather than self-interest. It's about creating a community of interest and peers that self-govern. It's about having an imperative in exercising one's work that goes beyond the market logic. It's about duty. It's about responsibility. It's about things like calling, vocation. It's that kind of infusion, which was really the original vision of the founders of business schools. Now, were they naive? You know, as Ed is suggesting, they may have been naive. But I think one should ask the question, if that's the social contract upon which they were legitimated and we're in a different place, you know, is this something we need to consider?
Edward Roberts, this takes us right to the heart of kind of the American conversation, or at least a big piece of it these days. Do you see for a higher imperative than the markets out there for business schools?
Well, higher imperative. I start with the Steve Kaplan quote that you provided, namely that I believe, it's not a statement of what the institution believes, I believe maximizing shareholder value is good because I believe that if you can first deliver sustained profitability in the enterprise, you can then begin to consider all the rest of the obligations and considerations that you have as more than a manager, but rather a leader. And if you are a leader, particularly of an institution that has a social conscience, then you worry about how is it that I can provide benefits to my workforce, to the communities that I'm in, to the society that I'm part of. But if you aren't profitable and making significant profits, you can't afford to even start to consider those issues. So I start with the Steve Kaplan criticism of Rakesh, that I think he's confused at the level of those goals. But it's broader than that, because to blame business schools for being unprofessional is a relative statement. Unprofessional, well, relative to what other professions? Law? Are we going to argue that the lawyers have done a wonderful job of taking care of all of that? Congress is run by lawyers. It's not run by MBAs. And are we really proud right. of the way they exercise judgment and scruples relating to the regulation of society? I think not.
Edward Roberts at MIT's Sloan School of Business, professor of management of technology there. You've given us a lot to think about with Rakesh Khurana in this hour. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Rakesh Khurana, the new book is From Higher Aims to Hired Hands. Please stand by, listeners. You can join us. B-School grads, did you get what you needed from B-School? Does the country? 800-423-8255 is our number. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the MBA in the U.S. economy and whether America's business schools and their graduates are letting down American business. Rakesh Khurana is with us from Harvard Business School. His new book is From Higher Aims to Hired Hands, The Social Transformation of American Business Schools and the Unfulfilled Promise of Management as a Profession. You can join us. What's a B-School's job? To educate hired guns for shareholders or community builders, economy builders for the nation? Can they not do both? B-School profs, are you educating the kind of leaders the country, the economy, really needs? B-School grads, did you get what you needed from B-School? 800-423-8255 is our number. Catherine's calling right now from Alston, Massachusetts. Hi, Catherine. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you for having me.
Yeah.
First of all, I just would like to thank Edward Roberts for making his last point about the law schools and the responsibility of the lawyers, because I appreciated that. But I'd also like to say that the MBA itself has evolved into a product. I'm in the process of applying to MBA programs right now, and mm-hmm. just the sheer volume of marketing materials with which I'm bombarded with every day is astounding to me.
They want you badly.
Excuse me?
They want you badly, apparently.
Well, we'll see. We'll see yeah. how that is. let's hope. So anyway, I think they're responding. They're selling a product. They're responding to their students, or if you want to call them clients, that's really who they are. And so I have to ask myself, is this a chicken or the egg kind of thing? I mean, did the MBA evolve for something noble into something, you know, less so in response to its students, or has it always been so... And students are responding to that.
Right, good.
So I just wanted to make the point that it is a product, and we can't forget that.
Let us pick it up. Catherine, thank you very much. Rakesh Khurana, she's applying. She sees it as a product. She needs that sticker from the MBA program to go on with her business life. This is what students want. Maybe this is what American business wants. Maybe it's the kind of grads they want to employ. So are you fighting the tide here? It's a product, she says.
Well, I think this is exactly the kind of logic that now has gotten into business schools, which is largely sees themselves as marketing and business school education as a business. And there have been a variety of factors, to take Catherine's question, that mm-hmm. have contributed to this. One is this notion of the student as a customer, which is a mentality that emerged as a consequence of the business school rankings that emerged in the late 1980s and in the 1990s.
Is it wrong?
Well, I think it's important that that we're talking about an education here. We're not talking about renting a car. We're talking about, in fact, helping individuals complete some sense of responsibility and recognition, inculcating them with a set of values, training them in a set of skills. And if we're merely purveyors of a product, to what connection, what's the legitimation then of having an institution like that in a publicly supported institution? Mm-hmm. One of the reasons Catherine sees all of those brochures, et cetera, is that business schools have adopted many of the techniques associated with businesses in terms of marketing themselves. They're in a very competitive area because there are no barriers to entry into the MBA business. For example, if a university wants to start a medical school, it's very expensive. If it mm-hmm. wants to start a law school, it's very expensive. The barriers to entry in business schools is very, very low. In 1930, there were about 30 business schools in the United States. Today, there's over 643.
You mean so the barriers of entry to starting a business school. 643,
and
that's
so,
a lot of growth.
As a result, that's not much quality control in MBA education either.
Let's take a call from Nate in Arlington, Massachusetts. Nate, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am an MBA grad, and I would probably have some words of warning for your previous caller, but I graduated right in 2003, right around shortly thereafter.
Okay.
When all the corporate scandals broke and business ethics were all the talk.
Right.
And I think your guest's point about the social contract is very interesting because, just as a brief example, my nickname in business school was the tree hugger. And we would get these cases about, doesn't matter, radar detector companies.
Okay.
And they're going through some business problem. And it was really amazing to me that the overwhelming response of my classmates was ship it to China. Shareholder value must be preserved, without a thoughtful discussion of what your guest talked about earlier, and that is sort of the larger social contract of business in America. It was just sort of this cutthroat, easy answer to say, well, let's maximize shareholder value, ship it to China.
And when you talked about a social contract or responsibility here, you got tagged the tree hugger.
I got tagged the tree hugger because I would tend to be the one raising my hand saying, well, wait a minute, if you ship this factory to China, or you ship this product manufacturing to China, you are decimating a town. That's not to say that a business case couldn't be made for sending it to China, but in an academic setting moderated by a professor who's supposedly widely read, widely knowledgeable about the implications of business and uprooting businesses and whatnot, I think that, and it was just sort of a very myopic view that was sort of endorsed by the school or by the class, and it was just sort of an odd thing. And now, 4 or 5 years later, I'm in the middle of a job search with an MBA,
right?
And I'm finding that the MBA, in and of itself, I'm a dime a dozen, and it's not the it doesn't not that I need to jump ahead in line or anything, but it's not a it's not seen as something that is, unless you're going to be a hedge fund manager or want to work in that sphere, it's just another degree.
Not a sure claim on a job. Nate, we hear that, the odd man out with the social contract notion there, and still not necessarily with a job. Let's get a call from Nashville, Tennessee, and Jared. Jared, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
You're welcome.
This is a fascinating discussion, It started with this notion that as a result of something in business schools now, these MBA grads are leaving in troves to go work at hedge funds.
Yeah.
And I'm assuming that was in, as opposed to going to, say, GM or Chrysler and being managers there.
I'm looking here, Jared, at some numbers, if I can just share these with you and the listener. University of Michigan, Ross School of Business, the percentage of its MBA grads that go to work in the auto industry, 1.5%. And maybe Michigan could use some good managers.
Right. How much of this is a function of the skyrocketing costs of these graduate programs, and then as a result, the mountains of debt that these students are graduating with, sometimes in the hundreds of thousands of dollars? We were talking before about economics. Maybe it's the economics of the micro level, where you've got a student, a graduate student facing 20 years worth of student loan payments that are going to be somewhere in between $500 and $1,000 a month.
So you'd better get that hedge fund job to stay on top of that. Jared, let us look at it. Rakesh, what do you say?
I think this is Jared's raising an important point about the economics of business education, and in particular, he would find that that students do often sometimes feel like they have to be steered into particular jobs that will sort of help them pay off their loans rather quickly. I guess the question then that raises in some ways is to what extent do business schools also have a responsibility of steering their students to other jobs. To what extent do we have a responsibility at some level to ensure that where are students going, that they understand that they, you know, that we, everybody can't just simply go into those type of areas, that we have to create recruiting opportunities, career opportunities. The problem is that there's a kind of cycle in which business schools are caught. Business schools are the only graduate schools whose ranking partly is determined by the starting salary of their students.
Mm-hmm.
You don't see this for medical schools or law schools. And as a consequence, the economic logic in many ways is sort of built into the nature of why people pursue the degree in the first place. And so business schools, in fact, are often ranked on their return on investment, for example, the way Forbes magazine ranks it, in terms of what's your starting salary after you go to the school. And that's really part of, I think, the dilemma that business education faces.
But don't a lot of people who come to B school see that as integral to the reason they're coming? I mean, maybe you're fighting the tide here. Maybe what you're describing should be the sociology department, not the B school.
Well, I think...
You quote Max Weber here a century ago, saying, "The idea of duty in one's calling prowls about in our lives like the ghost of dead religious beliefs." Maybe in the contemporary business world, this is a dead religious belief you're promoting.
Well, I think actually business schools do recognize they have a belief that goes far beyond the bottom line, which is perhaps why so many business schools increasingly describe their mission as one of educating leaders.
Yes, they do.
And while such mission statements are make nice copy, et cetera, educating leaders is not an easy thing to do. It involves talking about some very difficult questions that are currently not part of the issue of business school education, such as leadership for what? To what end? Leadership, what does it mean with respect to your responsibilities? What happens when you have conflicting duties, say one to a shareholder, one to an employee? If you simply hand out a technical view, which is the most important imperative is shareholder maximization, what you've created is a robot. Not a professional who has to actually apply judgment in the execution of their activities and their duties.
We're looking at the options here. You know, a couple of 3 years ago, we talked with Peter Drucker. I think it was the last interview he did. He was 95 at the time. And in a time when leadership skills are being emphasized in B schools, I asked him, and let's listen back. I'm not sure anybody's going to like his answer in this arena. I asked him how he thought American business schools were preparing students.
I think it's a great mistake to say that management and schools are charged with educating leaders. They are charged with educating competent mediocrities to do competent work. That's true of a medical school. It is not charged with educating leaders. It's charged with educating physicians who don't kill too many people. That's true of law schools. They're charged with educating people who can draft a decent will, not with legal leaders. You can't educate leaders.
The great Peter Drucker there in 2004, at age 95, maybe the last interview of his life. You can't educate leaders, he says. But then he says people are trying to turn out competent mediocrities. I don't know any B school that's going to put that on their marketing literature. Let's go to DB in Brighton, Massachusetts. DB, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I got my MBA at the Simmons School of Management,
yeah,
which is the only school of management in the country for women. And in our mission, we say... our mission is to educate women for positions of power and principled leadership.
Hmm.
I myself am a workplace mediator, and I'm curious about whether your guest did any research either at Simmons, or was there any differentiation between women who got their MBAs and men who got their MBAs?
Interesting question. Rakesh Khurana, men and women coming out of B school, do they take something different from it? Do they act differently once they start to go to work with that degree?
Well, I don't actually have any data on the issues of men and women and with respect to how they treat their degree. And one of the limitations of my study is that I do focus on what we would consider, quote unquote, you know, the elite education, because those were really the schools that were there at the founding and in many ways serve as the imprint for other business schools, both through educating faculty and moreover producing the teaching materials that mm-hmm. are used at other schools.
Let's go to Bill. Sorry, we don't have an exact answer on that, DB, but we take the implicit point you're making there. We'll keep an eye out for it. Bill is calling from Nashua, New Hampshire. Bill, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thank you. I've got my MBA from the Anderson School at UCLA.
Okay.
And I just disagree completely with the author's premise. I agree with what you said. It sounds more like he's describing sociology than he is business. These schools are, after all, schools of business. We're learning business techniques here. And businesses under the law are like people. And people have got a responsibility to take care of themselves. That's what we do. There are businesses that have got altruistic goals in mind. They're called not-for-profits.
But how is that working, Bill? Do you have any sympathy with what Rakesh is saying? I mean, look around. We see the kind of CEO pay that makes people really roll their eyes. We see the emphasis on finance and capital markets instead of necessarily building businesses that leave many Americans wondering if we're on the right track. Do you have any second thoughts about that?
Well, the business about CEO compensation is a whole other question, and there are ways to approach that just haven't been followed yet. But I believe that we are still the most productive country in the world. Our business has been successful. We're a model for the world, and it's because our corporations are based on the interests of the shareholders. As soon as you start basing your interests on something else, the corporation loses its focus and it doesn't become as effective or as efficient as it should be.
Bill, thank you very much for that. Rakesh Khurana, our time grows short. There's a point deep in the book where you say, that the MBA grads are not doing what they should in keeping us on top of new technology and globalization of trade, demographic trends, growing inequality between rich and poor. You also say that investor capitalism itself, and this is where everybody has an interest, may be unsustainable, if not actually obsolete. What do you mean by that? Are you saying that MBA the B schools are turning out people who aren't focused on the right thing at all? Are hedge funds obsolete? They seem to be pretty high in the saddle.
Well, I think the question is again of proportionality, and the question in many ways also is a decision that business schools have to make, which is who are we educating and for what end? Mm-hmm. Again, I don't want to sort of diminish the importance of these other activities, but the question is, are these the kinds of value creating activities that advance the welfare of society that the original participants who were behind the business school project saw, that in fact they made a very conscious decision that we were not going to be educating speculators. We were not going mm-hmm. to be educating narrow financial individuals, but broad-minded individuals who would contribute to the well-being of society. And particularly, they saw people who were creating organizations, administering organizations, building goods and services that affected large numbers of people. That is being the key. I think, to the point of the last speaker, the question is, a lot of institutions contribute to the vitality of society. Mm-hmm. But in the beginning, what makes these institutions come alive is the ultimate purpose. What's the point of business education? Is it to make money or is it to make the world a better place to live? These are two separate things. They're often congruent, but sometimes they are not. They're not congruent, for example, when the lion's share of economic benefits go to a small number of people. They're not congruent when an institution is willing to sacrifice its ultimate public purpose for narrow economic expediency. The question that I'm trying to raise in some view is that the society's well-being depends on the quality of its leaders that are being put out there. If we look within business, there is some question about whether the types of leaders that we have can handle the types of problems we're going to be facing in the 21st century. My argument is that where we are today is not some inevitable natural outcome. It was a historically contingent moment that is very different from how business schools were founded. Whether the question about whether management should be a profession, whether students should see their responsibilities in a larger way, I think that's a discussion question. And my aim in this book was to get a discussion started through data, not to sort of offer some simple answer.
We've got 20 seconds. If it doesn't get fixed, what consequences for the country, for the economy?
Well, I think the challenge is that increasingly, if you don't have a self-regulating body that's capable of controlling its own actions, you get increasingly regulation in the form of Sarbanes-Oxley. You get individuals who are running corporations in a very narrow, short-term way rather than thinking about the long-term implications of their actions.
So the market and the business may itself pay in the end. Rakesh Khurana's new book is From Higher Aims to Hired Hands. Professor Khurana, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.